The reading before the lesson will be from Matthew 25, verses 34 through 40. Matthew 25, 34 through 40. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? And when did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" The king will answer and say to them, "Truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me."
This evening we're going to be looking at a revamped sermon, and just providentially goes along with what we're studying on Wednesday night. In fact, it's the fourth of the series of parables that our Lord is teaching. Now, if you recall, the first two have to do with the sheep that went astray and the shepherd which went with it, and then the coin that was lost. And it seems, anyway, that the first one is talking about or giving the perspective of how God feels when one of his sheep go astray. And then the joy that is experienced in heaven. Now, these are all parables for the Pharisees because they didn't respect God's people, the sinners that were coming back. And Jesus is chastising the Pharisees in most of these. The second one with the coin, since it starts out a woman, it could possibly be the church, how it functions too, and it seeks after those that are lost, and the joy it experiences when the coin is found. Then we got into the parable of the prodigal son, which is not just about the prodigal son. How these things go together is you're looking at it from God's perspective, and what Jesus is trying to do is give the Pharisees the other perspectives also. And the parable which we call of the prodigal son is an interesting psychological insight into how the sinners are like the prodigal son, how they have gone away, they've squandered the Lord's inheritance, and fell on hard times, and then finally come to their senses. And those were the ones that Jesus was going to, seeking and saving the lost. And the Pharisees didn't like this at all. So the parable then switches over to really the insight of another kind of individual that's lost, and that's the Pharisees. That's the older brother, the one that isn't happy that his little brother came back and is now saved and returned to him, who's very self-righteous, who has basically, and as he's talking to his father, doesn't even address him as father. And we see the two, one that's gone away and has been lost and come back, and the Pharisee who's lost while in the house. Now, this fourth parable brings in the last side of this. Those that haven't wandered off, what are they likened to? And this is what we're going to be looking at. Wiser than children of light, and I put a question mark after that. Really? So as we look at the parable of the unrighteous steward, we're going to notice some things that a lot of people miss and bring it to a proper conclusion and tack on to the end of it. Things sometimes we look at individually, but don't realize that they really are part of the parable itself. So if you'll read with me, in Luke, the 16th chapter, verses 1 through 13, this is the parable often misunderstood and too often wrongfully applied. While it appears to make the children of God look like they're not as smart as the children of the world, in truth, men often miss the turn that Jesus puts into the parable and overlook his own simple application that makes the sons of God shine. In Luke 16, verses 1 through 2, you can follow up here or follow in your Bibles. This is the New American Standard Version. Now he was also saying, notice the also implies that this is going along with the other parables. They are connected both in the Greek and the English, if you look for the right words. He was saying to the disciples, and this is something he's pinning in, the Pharisees are going to overhear this, and you can see the reaction at the end of it. We're not going to get into that. We did that Wednesday night. But this was directed specifically to the disciples to let them know what a disciple is and let the Pharisees know. He says, there was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you're no longer the manager. Now, it is of primary importance to know that the application of the parable is for the disciples alone. This helps to rule out any interpretation of the Lord justifying lying and thievery. The essentials of the parable are laid out in a few and simple words. There was a rich man who had a dishonest steward employed as his general manager. This steward is denounced. There's nothing good about him. He's denounced for the way he's operated things. The rich man knows what he has heard, the rumors about it. He knows they're true. He knows why the steward did what he did. Nor does the steward reply in any way. He doesn't give any excuse. He's caught basically red-handed. And the steward then must go close up the books and turn them in with whatever they show. There's no time to amend them or change them or make things right. As it proceeds on at the third verse, the manager, and this is what we call the elaborated shrewdness of the servant, or what was commendable about him. We know it was sort of commendable. And there's parts of it that we can look at and draw from, but not all of it. The manager said to himself, what should I do since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. Okay, this is his alternative. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors and began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill, sit down, and quickly write 50. And he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. Through this, the Lord shows the manager's thinking. In this, he's, at least he knows he's got a problem, and he doesn't sit in the corner and cry, oh, woe is me. He starts thinking about what he can do. With little time, the steward quickly reasons, makes a prompt decision, and instantly executes his shrewd plan. The steward knows he's not strong enough for physical labor and is too proud to beg. We are not told how this all flashed in his mind or where it comes from, but we are privy to what he expects his plans to serve. Namely, to make his employer's debtors take him into their homes. He's looking for a place that he can reside in when this is over, so that he can live at ease until something better comes along, whatever, or at least just cut it off, someplace where he can go. In truth, he makes his master's debtors his own. Then each of the debtors is offered a better deal and is made to write the payment into the books. This way, the books are not altered. The men themselves are filling in the thing, so it's all there, plain to see. This makes it evident then to the master as he looks them over to point that even the master praises the steward for his shrewdness, to handling things, to make concessions for himself, to take care of himself. Now, basically in a parable, you look at, as you're measuring two things together, just where they touch. You can't go through all this thing and go, okay, well, thievery is being justified by God, and he's commending people that are really smart thieves and cunning. He's not doing that. He's commending the individual that's making plans for the future. And that's pretty much where it stops. Well, a few other parables that we'll point out, but the rest of it has to do with his disciples, in a different path. So this is not the object lesson, that of thieving shrewdness or cunning. The turning point is verse 8, in which people often take the wrong way. His master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age, as commentary Jesus has, are more shrewd in relationship to their own kind than the sons of light. Now, you might append that, then the sons of light are to the kind of those in the world. And that's what's kind of overlooked. As we go through this, note that the manager is called a steward of unrighteousness, which is a qualitative genitive in the Greek and a lot stronger as an expression than just unrighteous steward. Stronger in this sense. The man is a token of the sons of that age. They're all unrighteous stewards. They are deterred neither by conscience nor moral considerations. The steward didn't care how much he was hurting his master, how much he may be ripping off, you know, some of the debtors or whatever. He could care less. He didn't look at the consequences, even for himself, if he got caught. This is the way the world works. The sons of light are representative also of their age, and these are the disciples. But they are inserted in the workings with the kind of the sons of this age, in which circumstances they are, of course, not as shrewd or cunning or whatever as we have to work, you know, as disciples have to work in the world, in the same way the unrighteous are in worldly affairs. What the Lord is doing is comparing the nature of the generations, one marked by transient temporariness, you know, whatever. That is, the unrighteous steward was looking for homes here with its sins and its effects. The other is marked by the blessed and perfect conditions of heaven. That's what he's talking about then in the disciples, sons of light. What is often overlooked is the term sons, especially representing the latter. Sons marks their legal standing as heirs. The hearts of the sons are set on treasures of truth in heaven, while the hearts of the worldly ones are set on the treasures of this age. Now, the explanation as it comes to a head. In verse 9, as an explanation, Jesus says, I say to you, make friends for yourself by means of the wealth of unrighteousness. Again, he's talking to the disciples. So that when it fails, they will receive you into eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. He who is unrighteous in very little things is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Okay. So as we go through this, in these verses, in contrast, the Lord is telling his disciples to use this unrighteous wealth as they interrelate with the sons of this age to make friends who can receive them into eternal dwellings. Who are the friends? Well, who are the only ones that can receive you into eternal dwellings? The Father and the Son. So what he's telling the disciples is how you use the things of this world will determine whether the Father and the Son are going to receive you into the heavenly mansions. How a disciple may so use this unrighteous wealth is developed to some extent in Matthew 25, which I had Justin read. You use it to take care of God's people. You know, this is trading off or building a treasure in heaven. When you take what the earth has to offer and you use it for the kingdom of God and for Christ's subjects. When one takes care of one of Christ's own, he is doing it to him, Christ. This handling of the unrighteous wealth is judged three ways in this thing. First of all, the use one makes of it. Notice both individuals of this age and of the one to come are still using the same unrighteous mammon or whatever you want to call it. Okay. So you're determined by how you use this. The second part of this is the estimate one plays on it. You know, do you look at the things you're using as, well, just what it is? You know, the gold is dirt. Well, that's fine if we want to make, you know, use it as coin of the realm or whatever. You know, yeah, we realize what has to be done, how living is made. But what kind of estimate do you put on it? You know, it's something you can't take with you. You know, do you see that there's things that are more valuable, your relationship with God? You know, or does it become something more to you? So for so many people, this gold or whatever becomes their God. So what is seen here also is the resistance one offers to this. Do you resist the pull that it normally has on people, you know, as to be, you know, overwhelmingly more important than other things, especially spiritual things? Or can you resist to the point of you realize what it is? As we go through this very little thing he's talking about, which he talks about if you're not faithful in very little, the very little thing in this context would be the unrighteous wealth. If a disciple is not trustworthy in its proper use, how can he be entrusted with true riches? You know, the spiritual things that God has. The true riches here are stated as heavenly ones. They are also termed that which is your own. Because as a son, what you're looking for is an adoption into heaven. As you are received into heavenly mansions, you're received as an heir. Back again, like the former parable, like that prodigal son that came back, who wanted to go back as a slave, but received back by the father as a son in the house. In verse 13, point C is noted and explained. Earthly wealth not only tends to unrighteousness in its use, but also leads one to place the false estimate on its value. It also, thus, can make one its slave even while they think they are being slaves to God. Its natural pull is to the world and away from God. This is why so many people are deceived by riches and pleasures and things. The real disciple can truly resist this. The axiom then is one cannot serve two masters. He will either be loyal to one or despise the other. He will love the one and hate the other. The more you begin to make the mammon your God, the more you will despise God. The more you love the things of this world, the more you'll be irritated by God by telling you that you can't, you know, be involved in it. You can't serve both. You have to make a choice. And very few people, true disciples, make the right choice, and that's the problem. Note that one can love agapeo, the worldly master, the same way that one can love agapeo, God. This is why you have to understand the meaning of the term love. It's not just, you know, in many cases, an affection, whatever, although it can be in this case if you truly are affected, you know, have an affection for gold or wealth or whatever. That is to understand, you know, the term means to understand the value of something and to live with a corresponding purpose. A disciple, then, is one who understands the value of a relationship with God greater than the relationship they have with the world, and then purposes his life to work and serve as a proper steward for God. When one loves the world, then they start realigning things, and they work toward that purpose. And as if, you know, the world becomes their God. Note, as well, the beginning parallel. Now, as it goes along, and this is where, like, the parables are, you know, as he's comparing a discipleship with the world, yeah, they are closely almost parallel. The manager is a steward, as the disciples are stewards. The steward is entrusted with another's property, as are disciples. They're entrusted with God's property. Okay, the steward makes friends with unrighteous wealth, as do disciples. Disciples make friends, you know, with God in their use of the unrighteous wealth. But then comes an end to this parallel. Okay? The worldly one goes this way, and the righteous steward or disciple goes the opposite direction. At this point, the lines run opposite. The manager is looking to earthly houses, while the disciple is building toward an eternal home. When viewed this way, in such a comparison, and this is why we put the little question mark, who's really shrewder? Who has really seen the more correct use of time, money, and energy? The world may mock the Lord's disciples and often cunningly take advantage of them in their innocence. In fact, as we look at the world, you know, the world often looks at those in power, you know, in government or whatever, or they look to those that are very wealthy, you know, in industry. They say, well, that's it. You know, but they overlook the fact, how did they get that way? Too often, it's the wrong way. They've lied, they've stolen, they've cheated, you know, whatever. You know, they've violated laws, may even committed murder. That's the way the world works. Even the mafia goes, well, you know, business is business. You know, that's the way we do things. That's the world. And often, an innocent cannot compete in that world. Yeah. Now, there's times in the Bible when it shows that when God is with you and he decides he's going to make you wealthy, there's not a thing the world can do about it. So we have Abraham's, we have Barnabas's, and we have, you know, men that had wealth because God determined that was their gift. Yeah. But for the most part, sometimes we got to, you know, we're going to be taken advantage of in our innocence, in our trust, you know, if we're true disciples. Okay. But in the final analysis, who eventually wins out? You know, the richest people in the world, if they do not have God, all that wealth means absolutely nothing. That was their God. But once they enter the grave, they have to leave it all behind. Whereas the disciple is taking with him the most valuable thing in the world, and he's taking it in the next world. That is, a soul that's acceptable to God, that's been loyal and trustworthy and loving of the right things, and a desire to serve his master, his God. Okay? Who eventually wins out and is judged the more worthy manager of the things? And, as we say, rewarded accordingly. We're about to sing 338. As people look at life, in fact, yeah, probably use our prayer list. I remember as a young person, I don't know if it's the way they screen them or whatever, but usually in the bulletin there was only like two or three sick people. Yeah. In our prayer list, it just keeps growing and growing and growing. Are people getting, you know, sicker or whatever? Or maybe just living longer and things are catching up with them. But most of us, you know, feel as we go along, we're not aware of that we might make the list sometime. We live our lives, and oftentimes we may not even know what's wrong with us or that there is something wrong until eventually we feel something. When I was in the service, going through electronic schools, one of the things, you know, I ended up in a radar course. And the thing they tell us about the radar is it's like a microwave oven, a big microwave oven. In fact, it was originally designed to be a weapon to do with radio waves, what light, you know, lasers do with light waves. You know, just concentrate them, and they were supposed to knock planes out of the sky. But what they warned us about is you do not want to get between the feed horn and the parabolic dish because it's like sitting in the middle of a microwave oven. You know, and if you're there working on it and somebody flips it on, and I've heard a story that, you know, they did, the person doesn't feel it, the effects of it, until it's too late. That is basically, so all your nerves are on the outside. So you're kind of protected by anything that comes at you from the outside. Your nerves, you know, will feel the cut, the burn, whatever. But with the microwaves, they start cooking from the inside out. And there's no nerves to warn you. So by the time the cooking gets to the nerves that can feel it, you're already dead. Maybe you just don't know it. And that's kind of the way, we make another parable, is the way sin operates. Most people in the world don't know they're already dead. They're still functioning, and they haven't felt the effects yet. But they still have to be warned. They have to be told. Like I just told you about microwaves. You know? They have to be warned about sin and the damage it can do in your life. That most people are sick. And as we sing this song, they need the great physician. They need someone to put them back together, to mend the breaks, to mend the broken hearts, the broken lives, the dying souls. The world desperately needs God in its life. And it's unfortunately that they don't want it. They prefer to serve the mammon rather than the Creator. And hopefully our task is to get to them, or even tonight, if you're sitting in the audience and the lesson gets to you, now's the time to operate on it. Now's the time to do something before it is too late. So as we sing, we offer the invitation in the sense of, if you haven't been baptized yet, now is the time to get your sins washed away. Now's the time to take care of it. Okay? If you've already been given yourself to God, you realize that there is a cross to carry, that there are things in our lives that we need to address, to agonizingly crucify, to kill, to get rid of, in order to be acceptable to God. One of the things we sang this morning, we went through the process of all of me and none of God, and then a little bit of me, and a little bit of God, and a little bit of me, and then more of God, and more. Until we get to the point of Galatians 2:20, where Paul said, "No longer I that live, but Christ that lives in me." And that, as Christians, is what we're trying to accomplish. And that's a hard road. It's something where to totally give up self and make sure that God completely controls us in every aspect of our lives. If you need any kind of instruction, if you need the prayers of the congregation, whatever your needs are, this is what the church is here for, to help you get through it and help you get to a home in eternity. Won't you come as we stand to sing?